So guys, please interrupt me with any kind of question. So we know how everything really started. If you have read the brief history of time of Hawking, there is this very nice intro about all turtles way down. Okay, so this is of course a joke, just to tell you basically to set up the stage. And the stage is that we know that many things happen in the universe, starting from the turtles, maybe ninja turtles. And in particular, we know that today, I mean, roughly, there's been from the very beginning of what we can claim is the very beginning, there's been roughly 13.8 billion years where super particles became essentially what we observe today, like galaxies and our dear Earth and so on. But the real point that I want to make here is that, like, in these superparticles, we can detect today from these superparticles, in particular, a cosmic background radiation. It's the famous cosmic microwave background radiation, firstly measured in in its spectrum, the intensity, by COBE satellite. And this perfect black body spectrum tells us that the Hadley universe was in a state of thermal equilibrium. Okay. And on top of that, now we have great missions like Planck satellite, for instance, that tells us a lot about the content of our universe, and in particular also to the study of these anisotropies on top of a very homogeneous temperature map at first glance. We can learn a lot about specific ingredients in the universe. And in particular, today, we can get, I should be a bit more precise on this number, and I will be later, but we get a sort of percent level of knowledge of the baryon content with respect to the photon one. And at the 10% level, we also can claim how much helium-4 is in this baryon content, and also how many radiistic degrees of freedom were essentially active at that time. Now, all this to say that once we know that the universe was in a thermal state, very beginning, we can essentially trade the line of time with the one of temperature. And we know that today, the 2.77-ish Kelvin that I was describing before correspond to 0.23 millielectron volt. Back in time, okay, we go in the direction where the universe was hotter and was like denser, and we end up with the cosmic microwave background at the essentially recombination that was at temperature of 0.25 electron volt. But most importantly, before that, before recombination, we have the synthesis of light elements that correspond to the period of Big Bang nucleosynthesis that is around the MeV. Okay, so these are all known things for you, I guess, but I wanted to just set up the stage also for the students. And now we can start to look at the BBN era in the standard cosmological model. So the first thing we should specify, we should characterize, is essentially the background of this universe that is expanding in a radiation domination, in a radiation domination era. So for temperatures above 10 MeV, we have essentially three radiistic species that are characterizing essentially the rate expansion of the universe at the time. And here is the well-known Friedmann equation, where on the right-hand side you have the counting of the degrees of freedom of these three radiistic species. And thanks to StatMac, we know that these densities as relativistic should scale as 2 to 4. On top of the Friedmann equation, we have the first law of thermodynamics that with the conservation of the stress energy momentum tensor, the total one, allows you to prove that also entropy is conserved, where the entropy density is defined as shown here, as essentially the sum of the density, energy density, and the pressure over the temperature. And eventually, I want to stress that these two equations combined allows you to know the temperature as a function of time and the temperature as a function of the scale factor, which almost characterize the background of the universe in radiation domination. I'm saying almost, because as you know, there is a little complication, and the little complication is the essence of the discussion that we are going to have today. The little complication is that, like, while the universe is expanding and cooling, we have the freeze-out of we can have the freeze-out of some of the interactions that are characterizing the crosstalk of the particles in this primordial soup, and in particular, the weak interactions are the standard textbook example of this freeze-out process that I'm referring to. So essentially, when the rate of interaction, or in this case of weak interactions, is no longer so fast with respect to the expansion rate of the universe, these interactions freeze out. And you can estimate the temperature at which this happens. And essentially, this estimate is based on how many realistic degrees of freedom you have characterizing H on the left-hand side, the field migration that I showed you before. And on the right-hand side, you have essentially the number density of realistic particles at scales like T cube times the typical cross-section, velocity average cross-section for weak interactions that must scale like G Fermi squared and by dimensional analysis with a T squared in front. So you know that the essentially putting the numbers in, you get that these weak interactions freeze it at the MEV scale. And supporting this with this notion, with the entropy conservation that I was referring to before, at temperatures much smaller now than the MEV, smaller actually than the mass of the electron, you can also prove that the neutrino temperature that I freeze out is equal to still equal to the one of the photon is slightly smaller, okay? And this is due to the fact that E plus E minus annihilate in two photons, and they heat up a little bit the photon gas with respect to the neutrino species, okay? So this information is important because it gives us the possibility to define an observable, that is this effective here. It is nothing else than a relative of how much deviation there is with respect to the photon density and of the total energy density that is present at that time. And you can compute it in the standard model precisely. And if you look, for instance, at this very recent review, you get this number, where the claim uncertainty is exactly on the last digit that I'm showing there. So all in all this discussion that is very well known by every one of you, I guess, allows you to characterize really the background with three functions, not two, as I claimed before. One is the photon temperature as a function of time. One is the photon temperature as a function of the scale factor. But you also need to know the relation between neutrinos and photons in order to be really happy about the description of the background. OK, having said that, which is, I hope, not too boring, we can jump into the real topic of this discussion, which is BBN. Now, BBN starts with the consideration that at the time, essentially, a temperature greater than the MEV, you do have, and this you know because you measured from the CMB, you know that there are some variance around, in particular, these variance are neutrons and protons, and are in beta equilibrium. So again, weak interactions that we saw before for the neutrinos are in equilibrium above the MEV, is exactly in equilibrium also, allowed to have in equilibrium also these reactions that I'm writing here. So essentially, the typical conversions of neutron and proton to W exchange. And this equilibrium allows you to write very simply the ratio of the number density of neutrons over protons. And this is written, of course, for non-relativistic species, because you know that the mass of these particles is at the time close to like the MEV. These species are non-relativistic, okay? So you use essentially the the distribution of the Boltzmann distribution of the Fermi Dirac or the of a relativistic species, in this case, right, for fermions. Now, the exponential that I'm writing there in this ratio is very sensitive to the difference of the masses of these particles, which is driven, as you know, by the violation of strong isospin in QCD, carried out by the difference in the quark masses and by QED effects. And in the end, this ratio for high temperatures is basically one, but while the universe is expanding and it cools down, at some point you hit the freeze out of the weak interactions, and this ratio of the number of neutrons over protons freezes out exactly at a value of 1 over 6, simply computed just putting the MeV scale in that T there. Okay, so no magic here. Very simple. Question about this? This should be very well known. But please stop me whenever I'm saying something that is weird. No? So now, the expectation, once this ratio freezes out, and so essentially neutrons freeze out from the plasma, is that nucleosynthesis should have essentially started. So neutrons and protons should bind, because the typical energy scale for the first simple two-body process that would give you deuterium is characterized by the binding energy of the deuterium, that is about 2.2 MeV. So why this doesn't happen? Well, it doesn't happen immediately. It doesn't happen at the MeV scale, because you have a lot of photons that can still dissociate the bound state of the deuterium. Okay? In equations, not in words, the reaction Mp to d gamma is proportional to the number of density of baryons times the characteristic cross section. The other direction of the reaction instead is proportional to the number density of photons that you have at your disposal times some suppression factor, some Boltzmann suppression factor that takes into account the binding energy of the bound state. And if you take the ratio, you see that essentially the two reactions are comparable in both directions only when this number density, and here this number density became an eta, sorry, this is an N and this is an eta, so it's the ratio, it's the bound-to-photon ratio here, is comparable to this exponential. What does this mean? It means that this T nuclear naively would be order MeV. In real life, it must be 0.1. So Big Bang nucleosynthesis really starts at 0.1 MeV. So once we reach the 0.1 MeV, everything starts immediately to build up the most stable thing. The most stable thing is helium 4. Okay. Now, the simple computation I showed you then is just to replace this ratio that I have computed on MeV to the equivalent number at 0.1 MeV. From MeV to 0.1 MeV, what happened? Happened just that, like, the neutron could decay sometimes, okay? You take into account this neutron decay, and the 1.6 becomes 1 over 7. That's the only thing you have to do. Then you assume that all the neutrons are going to helium 4, and you come up with this fantastic prediction of the mass fraction in helium 4, which is essentially a ratio of not of number densities with respect to baryons, but a ratio in terms of mass densities, okay? So you can write this M of helium 4 as 4 times the number of nucleons that characterize the helium 4. Now, helium 4 is characterized by 2 neutrons and 2 protons, so in particular you can write it as the number density of neutrons half over the sum of the number density of neutrons plus protons. You divide the numerator and denominator by the number of protons, you use that 1 over 7, you get 0.25. No, again, very simple. Now, this can be essentially considered the the pillar of the prediction in VBN at the blackboard. Of course, then there is a more complicated situation that is the one where you would like also to predict the other abundances. And to do this, you need to work out a little bit harder. I can tell you that once these fusion reactions freeze out, there is still a 10 to the minus residual amount of deuterium and helium 3, and eventually also some amount of helium 7 of a very, very small number in number density relative to the hydrogen or the number of protons that you have. So, in few words, VBN is a very inefficient process, okay? Where really you make up the helium at the level of 25%, and the rest is a very small amount of stuff. Okay? Now, I will comment, no worries, about the other abundances that are so small. But before doing that, let me just show you the typical thing that everyone should know, borrowed from the PDG. So, typically, VBN is claimed to be, these days, in the standard model, parameter-free theory. What does that mean? It means that if you buy information of the baryon-to-photon ratio from Planck, for instance, from the measurement of Planck, and at the same time, you assume only the relativistic species that characterize the standard model, in particular three species of neutrinos, then essentially you don't have three parameters to play with a priori. And within this statement, you would just like hit a specific point in this plot. Of course, you can play the game of not assuming the amount of baryon density, and then you can start to draw these wonderful curves that you see here, okay? And see the sensitivity of these elements with respect to the amount of baryons back time. Now, this plot is to show you, in first place, that there is a very good agreement on what you can measure, what you can predict, together with the information that you have from the cosmic microwave background. So what is the most successful prediction in this sense? Well, you can see here, the most precise measurement comes from deuterium, the relative abundance of deuterium with respect to hydrogen, is really in good agreement with the CMB, with this crossing of the CMB stripe, vertical stripe, the measurement that is this yellow bar, and the blue line that is the prediction from VBN, bearing the baryon-to-photon ratio. Okay, so there is some concordance here. Same concordance can be noted with less amusement from the helium-4 measurement, which is less precise than the deuterium. And eventually, you can see that there is no white yellow stripe for helium-3, and for lithium-7, there is some offset in what you essentially would like to explain according to the observations and what the CMB would like to have you with the baryon-to-photon ratio that we know. So lithium-7, as probably you know, is an issue. And now let me comment on these observations in order to convince you exactly that from that point of view, we can still be happy today. So how do you measure? So where does this yellow stripe come from? Well, helium-4 is observed in ionized gas regions in metal-poor galaxies that are far from our galaxy, okay, not too far, but like in extragalactic environments. Now, in particular, what you do, you study the emission spectra of these nebulae of gas ionized, and you need some modeling that I will slightly comment on in order to extract this measurement. And the modeling is the reason why this stripe was not very precise, okay? There is some uncertainty, some systematic uncertainty in the modeling of this emission spectra. The deuterium is instead much more precise because it comes from the study of quasar absorption systems, and in particular on the study of the spectra of these objects in absorption can be shown to be much more robust once you selected a number of objects for which you are sure that you're understanding the spectra. I will comment on that as well. Enum 3 is not the lucky guy here. There is no real environment where you can claim that there is no pollution from stellar nucleosynthesis. So what you want to do is to look for environments, I didn't stress that, where the metallicity essentially is low, in order to claim that these are environments that are close to a pristine kind of initial conditions, okay, that resemble the BBN1. This is your hope. Eventually, lithium-7. Okay, lithium-7, as all of you have heard, as I showed you in the previous plot, is in principle a puzzle. Now, it is measured in the atmosphere of metal-poor yellow stars, in particular dwarf yellow stars, close to us. And the reason of the atmosphere is because essentially is where the elements are at birth in the star. And the fact that like lithium-7 could be or could not be a problem is related to the fact you need to know the physics of this atmosphere in the halo of the stars. And there was a very recent work from Keith Olive, Brian Fields, and collaborators, that are the people that also take care about the PDG review on BBN, for instance, and they have been driving the field for a while, where they show that this physics of convection actually is not very well understood. And recently, some data that were essentially supporting low level of turbulence in this atmosphere of this halo of the halo of the stars seems to no longer be supported by data. In particular, there was some measurement of lithium-6 together with lithium-7. Now, lithium-6 is much less stable than lithium-7, and this indicator is no longer there in the new data, the new measurements of this star. And therefore, now it's believed that lithium-7 can be destroyed by convection from the outer part of the star and be brought inside the inner part of the star. And therefore, it might be that the fact that we have some some discrepancy here is just due to the fact that this measurement is not really considered as one for a primordial lithium-7 abundance. Okay, I just described a very long paper in few words, so please take a look at the paper. Now, wait, yes.
So I just understand that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry. Okay, so this paper is saying that in these stars, all of the primordial lithium has been destroyed via
Not all. I mean, you just don't know really hard because the indicator was lithium-6. The presence of lithium-6 in this atmosphere was a sort of a marker to tell you that the lithium-7 that was in that atmosphere was all primordial. This was the claim, okay?
So now, this isn't produced in BBN. Sorry, so I don't
lithium, know. No, but it's much less stable. So if you were not destroying lithium-6, even if it was a product of astration, it was not a product of BBN, you were just saying that, okay, if lithium-6 is here, then lithium-7, that I'm observing has not been ever destroyed. But then the origin of lithium-7 is different from lithium-6. Lithium-7 was assumed to be primordial. Now, since lithium-6 now is no longer, the abundance of lithium-6 is no longer measured well in this new data, okay? I mean, basically, this data became an upper bound. Now, you don't know how much lithium-7 anymore is really primordial, because then the physics of convection that you need in order to claim that has not been depleted is no longer constrained. While lithium-6 was allowing you to constrain that convection physics, okay?
Okay.
I mean, more than this.
My question of this lithium-7 measurement, was that there would be very uniform lithium-7 abundance across our huge range of iron abundance. So huge range of iron is supposed to be probing like different metallicity.
Yes, but also that thing now has a slope. I mean, it's no longer also, yeah, but I know what you're talking about, but you should look at the plot. It's hard to tell you more without any information from that paper, but essentially, the thing that you are describing was based still on the fact that you could assume that no lithium 7 was depleted.
Right, but the argument for that, I thought, was
the correlation with the metallicity. Yeah. It's not just enough. You need the lithium 6.
Okay.
Essentially, the atmosphere, you need to model the atmosphere to accept the number density, okay? You need to model the atmosphere physics. And the atmosphere physics can be in a thin or thick convection kind of regime.
Okay.
And the assumption was that it was thin. Sorry, it was thick. So lithium 7 was not going to the inner part of the star, and it was not destroyed. This is like poor words of my poor understanding of this paper. Okay, now I want to convince you. In brief time, I'm really slow here, that like helium-4 and deuterium are percent level measurements that are under control. Now, we never managed to do that really, but let me just comment on the fact that, okay, the PDG value recommended is that one. And here there is a sample of metal poor galaxies from which you do this analysis of the emission spectra in these H2 ionized regions. And essentially, you see a plot similar to what Neil was describing, that is like the abundance here in number density, the relation of from number density to mass fraction is this one. Okay, so you can the two variables are can be like trade one for each other. The reason why people use YP in this instead of the number density is just historical. Okay, but I mean as astronomers, first of all, measure the number densities, and then they convert it into mass fraction. So this is a plot of relative number density of helium-4 with respect to hydrogen versus metallicity, traced by oxygen here. And the claim of metal-poor is that this metal-poor environment means that the amount of oxygen should be above the 10% level of what you find in the sun, but not so much more, okay? Still below like 20% or something, between 20 and 10%. So this characterizes these objects. You have several information that comes from several surveys, CAC, SDSS, and also the large binocular telescope, another survey. And in particular, you need to do observations in optical and infrared. In infrared, because you need some new lines like this helium-1 lambda 10830 that you see there, that allows you to break degeneracies in parameter space, because basically you need to model the gas, the clouds basically of these H2 regions that are ionized gas that essentially depends on temperature, on the number density of electrons, on some kind of ionized coefficients that you need to essentially model. And for instance, the measurement of this emission line of helium allows you to break a famous degeneracy of number density of electrons versus the temperature of the cloud, which was fundamental in order to arrive to that kind of precision. Okay? Otherwise, in the extraction of this number, you are not able to have that kind of claim. You are dominated by systematic uncertainties. Now, assuming that you can describe the spectra very well, then what you do is to collect a number of objects as a function of metallicity, and then you do the extrapolation, or better, the interpolation towards the zero metallicity limit, and you get this number here, for instance, in this study in 2020 from Xavier Prochaska and collaborators, that is very close to the overall PDG recommended value. For the deuterium, you do a similar game, but not really, at the level of absorption spectra. So here you have a quasar that you use as a light bulb that is essentially illuminating the gas that is along the line of sight with respect to your observation. And essentially the color absorbed correspond to the lines that you can see in this spectrum. And in particular, there are very clear kind of features that characterize the presence of metals, but also the famous Lyman alpha continuum that has a sort of shift here. And this shift is due to the isotope of the presence of the D that, and this is the most important information for you, D is always destroyed in stellar nucleosynthesis. So if you find some presence of D, this must be primordial, okay? Now the question is if you can really believe that this is really the exact original primordial abundance, or is some residual fraction of it, okay? So the game is to find the objects for which you can be sure that the astration process, so stellar pollution, has been in the story of these environments basically totally negligible. So this is an assumption. There are some markers, some indicators in order to do that. And eventually you can do again a plot like the one, the previous one that I showed you, of metallicity versus the abundance. Now see a crucial difference here. The crucial difference is that here there is no correlation with metallicity. It's basically, you see, this is, there is some scatter here, okay? These are data. But essentially there is no indication that this abundance changed drastically with respect to the amount of oxygen detected. And this essentially is a proof, in principle, that you are really measuring the primordial abundance and you are not extrapolating. Okay, percent level measurement as well. Now, percent level measurement implies precision era. And precision era implies that you cannot do the computation at the blackboard. So this is the statement in order to present you to have some marketing time for me and sell you this code that I've been working on for a bit, like 2 years. So this code is called Primordial and is essentially supposed to tell you everything about the first 3 minutes of the universe in much less time, you know, or the 10 seconds. Now, of course, the claim is computer dependent, is user dependent also. And it's a work in progress, so you cannot find it yet on the GitHub, but hopefully this will happen by the end of the year. And it's essentially a work that I've been carrying out as I was telling you with a PhD student in Irvine, Catherine Burns, and Tim Tate. And Tim wanted to stress in my talk that this is a younger version of me, but also this is a younger version of him. So he really cared about this, so I had to highlight that. Now, why another BBN code? Guys, you could complain about it. In fact, there is also benefit in not writing codes. If you don't write codes, there are no bugs, right, that you can generate. Now, the reason why, it's very simple. So there are 3 codes, okay, that are very well known in public. There are more codes than those, but these represent close to the state of the art. So Primat and Partinopi are really reproducing the state of the art in the field. Alter BBN is a sort of a lighter version where you can however play much more easily with respect to these other 2 codes when you want to do BSM physics, okay? Now, the reason zero is that I like to be user-friendly. Now, Neil would have some objection on this probably, but I will come back to that later. Now, Primat is in Mathematica is a wonderful, wonderful code, and much of the work that I've been carrying out was based indeed on what I learned from that notebook, Mathematica, that is essentially an endless notebook. Alter BBN is very fast, is written in C, but again, as I told you, if you want to do a state of the art, Alter BBN doesn't meet the standards, okay? So allows you to give an idea on how things change in BSM scenarios, but if you want to do a precision study, it's not the code that you can use. As you can see, as you can imagine, primat in mathematica, even if it represents the state of the art, is going to be very slow. And eventually, this Partinopi that is important, and good luck with that. Okay. Now, so reason zero was that one, very like briefly. Reason one is that I had the idea. And this idea was borrowed from these works that I'm highlighting here in red, that are works from Miguel Escudero. So these are single author papers that are amazing, in my opinion. And essentially are papers in relation to how to perform a computation of neutrino decoupling from scratch in order to predict an effective and the relation between the photon temperature and the neutrino temperature without having to solve a nightmare of equation like the Vlasov equation I'm writing there at the very beginning for the phase space distribution neutrinos. Now, this is a very simple approach that at the beginning was not guaranteed to be working well, but Miguel Escudero, I don't know if you know him, just gave it a shot, and it seems that it works amazingly well. And it's essentially, in few words, is just good thermal. So technically speaking, you cannot assume at some point, if you want to do a precise computation in decoupling, you cannot assume any thermal distribution for these particles, okay? The thermal distribution must be something you derive from this equation. But if you assume that, you can essentially take the moments of that Vlasov equation and end up with some Boltzmann equation for the temperature of the two species. And in particular, now what is left to do for you is just to compute the matrix elements, as you typically do as a particle physics that like to study in the universe. So nothing really special after all. So the collision term is this delta rho dot. And eventually, with the Friedmann equation, you can combine these two equations and this and get, as a byproduct, the photon temperature as a function of time, but also the neutrino temperature as a function of time, and eventually, implicitly, also the relation between T gamma and T nu. And notice that this is like an ab initio computation. All the other BBN codes, and this is what I want to stress, rely on some external input where some people already solved the very complicated Vlasov equation from the beginning, okay? But what does this mean? It means that all the BBN codes, from this point of view, assume the standard model. And if you want to go beyond the standard model here, you need to do a lot of work. Now, with this simplified approach, you can, first of all, be sure that you recover everything in the standard model that you would expect, in particular an effective, but also the standard relation of the scale factor with temperature and time. But most importantly, now you can go beyond the standard model in a very easy way. Let's assume that you have a dark sector. You want to study now the cross talk of this dark sector with the standard model one. Before it was a nightmare. Now you can do it. So this is why, in first place, I decided to start this enterprise, because this opens up a new study of the dark sectors in an easy way, let's say. I'm going a little bit faster because I still have to say a lot of things for you today. So now, reason two is the fact that like there was no fast code to compute from the very beginning the Newton to proton conversion. Now, this seems to be crazy because it's just weak interactions. But in order to reach the precision that you need, actually, it's not just like the three-level diagram, but you need to start to put QD corrections, thermal corrections, finite mass effects from isospin breaking. So actually, this computation is what is taking like most of the time in Mathematica when you use Primat. And now in Python, thanks to Vegas, it's fast. Believe me or not, it's fast. Reason three, there is no code. There was no code where you could have implemented easily and study the effect of different assessments for the nuclear rates. So I didn't talk much about it so far, but in order to predict things that are not Helium 4, you really need to do a lot of work in terms of Boltzmann equations for complicated nuclear reactions. Now, the state of the art is a Primat that implements something like 400 reactions. So it's like a huge system. Now, if you start to study these things, so the reason why people ended up coding 400 reactions is just because they were trying to solve the lithium 7 problem. And they just were wondering if they were missing some important cross-section reaction. So it was a very empirical approach. Now, these days, especially if you want to ignore the lithium 7 problem, and you're interested in the prediction of helium 4 in deuterium, you don't really know. You don't really need order 100 reactions. You need order 10, okay? But still, these order 10 have a lot of uncertainty. And no code was giving you a real glimpse on like the different approaches in the study of this cross-section nuclear data. Now, let me just stress that there are some good examples of data where now, thanks for instance from this very recent measurement of this LUNA collaboration, where it doesn't matter what is the approach you take in order to fit those data. If you have some theory prior, if you are completely data-driven, the data now, these red points here, are so precise in the range that you are interested for BBN that essentially you don't care. Okay, but this is a very specific reaction for which we are lucky that now we have this knowledge. Other reactions that involve deep diffusion, for instance, are not well measured. And depending on the approach that you take, things change. So in this code, you will find the possibility to use a very conservative kind of approach that is basically data-driven, and one that is instead more based on nuclear modeling. And these are some energy sort of dependence prior. And as you can see in this plot that I'm showing of cross-section versus temperature, things can be very different, okay? And in particular, the theory prior can give you a much smaller uncertainty than a completely naive data-driven polynomial fit. So I think this is a very important uncertainty that one should sort of take under control, okay? Okay, now, this is a scheme on how WikiHow on how primordial should work. And I mean, there are several steps that you do with several kind of libraries that you're calling, okay? Sources, like sub-pieces of the code. And eventually, first you solve the background, then you compute the weak rates from scratch. And eventually, which is important, because if you have new physics, also the weak rates will be modified. So you need to compute them from scratch. And eventually, you solve the nuclear reaction set of equations. And as promised, in my laptop, this ends up being something order 10 in seconds. OK. So I wonder if you were wondering what is the effect of these nuclear reaction uncertainties. So this is what I wanted to stress. So this is the state of the art that I reproduced with my code about BBN. Okay. So here you can see the classic triangle plot of a Bayesian analysis, assuming the Planck Gaussian prior for the baryon to photon ratio. But varying the neutron lifetime, which also is an important quantity that you need to take into account in your weak rates. And most importantly, the cross-section, the nuclear cross-section uncertainties. As you can see, depending on the approach that you have, you can really come up with a different statement on the abundance of deuterium over hydrogen. Now, this is in the community, it's not really a big news, okay? There has been some debate, some fight between the French group of the Primat people and Keith Olive and collaborators, and also the guys from Partinobi, because everyone was getting a different deuterium abundance. And the reason is just that one, okay? So the fact that we don't have a precise measurement for all the DD reactions implies that the uncertainty depending on the approach on the nuclear rates, can go from 1.5% to 4% level. Now, notice that also the central value changes. And in fact, in this posterior, the blue one shows some kind of tension with the measurement. A tension that is no longer there when you take the more conservative approach on these cross-sections, okay? On the other hand, notice that this cross-section uncertainties do not matter for YP, because YP is very sensitive to what you do with the weak rates. And today we can predict this mass fraction for helium 4 at the level of 0.5 per mil level. So amazing precision from the theory point of view. Okay. Here is an example of BSM that you can do with my code, but I mean, I don't have time to go through, so please ask me later. Okay. All in all, Primordial, in summary, is a fantastic code that you should download as soon as it's available. And most importantly for Neil, the differential equation thing is made faster with Julia. Now, after dinner last night, I need to cross-check if I'm doing some computation wrong because of the +1 based index. So if you see something wrong in my numbers, it's just because you need to shift by +1, okay? I'm joking.
Is that part of the purpose?
Just saying. Okay, so I'm Italian and this is the short summary for Primordial. Now let's go to what I wanted to talk about, and I don't have so much time to do that now. So the new helium measurement that I wanted to talk about today is essentially a reinforcement, an expansion, if you want, of the data that I was showing to you before, from essentially the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and also from the Keck observation. Okay. Now, the Subaru telescope that is in Hawaii is in particular a survey that, like, an instrument that the National Astronomical Observatory of Japan can use. And this Japan collaboration made of older 30 people or so, essentially measured these emission spectra for H2 ionized regions for 10 new galaxies, okay? 10 new galaxies that are characterized by oxygen over hydrogen abundance that is less than 10% than the solar one. This characterized these objects as extremely metal poor and are the sexiest objects that you can find in order to make this measurement. Now, of these 10 objects, only 5 were really used, because you don't need only only infrared measurements, but also optical one, in order to break all the degeneracies in these lines. So these guys, despite they got 10 objects from their near infrared measurements, only 5 were really used in this fit. But the whole point is that their measurement, that is this red thing there, is much, if you want, it points to a mass fraction of helium 4 that is much smaller than the one that was previously assessed in other works. In particular, the one that I was describing to you is the one in 2020, the one of these HSYU et al, okay? That is like, I know in this collaboration, Sarah Prochaska. Now, the important thing is that you can play a game with this data, no? And this is what the collaborations did. If you remove these new data points, can you get again the same number that these guys in 2020 were getting? And the answer is almost yes. So this point, black point with the error bar, is showing to you what they get when they remove the new 10 objects, actually 5 extremely metal poor galaxies that they included in the fit. So this could be an indication that, after all, the measurement the inference that they're doing is genuine. Nevertheless, I know that there are people that are skeptical about this. Now, what does this measurement implies? Well, let me just review extremely briefly the BBN era with chemical potential different from zero. When the early universe, you know, the chemical potential of photons must be zero. And in particular, this implies also that the relation between particle and antiparticle chemical potential. Okay. Now, from charge neutrality of the early universe, you can also claim that any asymmetry in the number density of charged leptons must be very small, okay? Must be bounded by the baryon to photon ratio. However, you know that there is another option to play with in the lepton sector, and this option is given by neutrinos. Now, a non-zero chemical potential for neutrinos can impact the first of all, the energy density. So the first question is, what is the size that you can get that doesn't spoil the bound on an effective? Now, as long as the CMB is conserved, you can show that the ratio of the chemical potential neutrino over the temperature of neutrino, if it's smaller than 0.1, you're not gonna see anything in the CMB, okay? Even assuming just lambda CDM plus an effective. However, in BBN, there is another effect, and this effect is the 2-beta equilibrium. Now, the relation detailed balance of this reaction is telling you that the chemical potential of neutron plus the one of neutrino must be equal to the one of proton plus the one of the electrons. But as I told you before, the one of the electrons must be very small. So in the end, you can relate the difference of the chemical potential of neutron with proton to the one of neutrinos. And now, if you remember how the Boltzmann distribution is at finite chemical potential, you gain essentially the difference of the chemical potentials here, but the difference of the chemical potentials between neutron and proton is equal to the one of neutrino, according to detailed balance. And so you have that this chemical potential neutrino is impacting the neutron to proton ratio. Now, it's very interesting, this thing, because now you can clearly see that the helium-4 measurement is an amazing leptometer. In particular, a positive chemical potential neutrino decreases the ratio of neutron to proton, which implies a smaller helium-4 abundance, according to what I told you before at the very beginning of this talk. Okay, this is very important. If you didn't understand that, please ask me again, even if there are only 3 minutes left. So let's say 5 so that I have 2 minutes more because we just didn't start really in time. Okay, so we did a Bayesian analysis where we varied essentially, we combined information from the CMB, the one of the BB of the BBN. And in particular, we assumed as measurements the recommended one for deuterium from PDG 2021, but for the helium, we used the new Subaru measurement. And this is the piece of the likelihood of the BBN that needs to be added to the one that comes from the CMB, where we have exploded the information that I'm giving you here from the Planck 2018. But in particular, we didn't get the likelihood from lambda CDM, of course. We are not fools. We got the one where, in the analysis of Planck, the helium abundance was treated as a free parameter. And effective was still a free parameter. And we, in particular, the Planck collaboration gives you the correlation matrix also of these three quantities, YP and effective and the abundance of baryons. And therefore, in our analysis, we took into account also this correlation. Now, the main parameters of our fits are an effective, the abundance of baryons, and a chemical potential of neutrinos. There are nuisance parameters. And these are the neutron lifetime and the nuclear cross-section uncertainties that I've been talking about before. Now, a good reason to go Bayesian is given by XKCD, but I don't want to review that for you. There are some nice results that I will show you in terms of posterior, but let's jump to the mid. And the mid is the inference of this, chemical potential that is a hint for some lepton asymmetry in the early universe. So at the 2 sigma level, you can see that I can detect some amount of order percent, okay, 4% if you really take the mean there, of this xi nu quantity, so mu nu over t nu. And this is done in this plot in a joint posterior with delta ineffective to show you an important fact. An important fact is that depending on the uncertainties and the approach of nuclear cross sections, you can or not infer also a delta ineffective difference from zero. But there is always the same solid inference of the chemical potential different from zero for neutrinos. And the reason why delta ineffective for this blue is different from zero, like almost one sigma, and while in the case of red, you are really compatible with zero, is due to the fact that the blue one is the approach of nuclear uncertainties where you have some deuterium anomaly, you have some tension also with deuterium, and so you need some extra realistic degrees of freedom in order to address also the deuterium observation. While this NACRI2-driven is the conservative approach to nuclear uncertainties, and therefore the only thing that really matters in the fit from the BSM point of view is the lepton asymmetry, okay? So the detection statistical, the statistical level is weak. It's just 2 sigma, okay? I'm not claiming any serious discovery here. Now, you can compare results, but I really, this can be done, for instance, with information criterion, and as a summary, you can look at that later, maybe, you can find that essentially models with non-zero lepton asymmetries are clearly preferred, okay? Not strongly, but with a positive evidence. Now, 2 words just at the very end on what this implies. Now, this inference, first of all, implies some asymmetry in the lepton sector, no? Now, I didn't talk at all about the flavor, okay, of this lepton asymmetry. And the flavor must be, in our inference, only the electron flavor neutrino 1 a priori, okay? Why? Because we were studying beta equilibrium with the neutron and the proton, and this involves only the electron neutrino, okay? So this psi bar nu, technically speaking, is only the a priori the electron neutrino 1. But there is something that complicates the story, and the fact is that you need to know now what happened to the details of the beta of neutrinos before the freeze out of weak interactions for at MeV, or saying this better, you need to include the effect of oscillations in a careful study in order to assess which kind of flavor mixed with the other ones. In particular, if you start with an asymmetry in the tau sector, you could easily generate one through the effect of oscillations at the MeV scale, also in the muon sector. And the electron one would also be generated despite the initial condition as the mu one was zero. Now, this is just because, you know, the final answer at the MeV, that is what I'm detecting in my fit, really depends on the details of the PMNS matrix, okay? And it's a difficult study to reverse engineering the process. So I can just tell you that I can detect that parameter, but the physics really behind this needs to be worked out more in terms of the lepton flavor. Eventually, I wanted to say a few words about the interpretation. Now, this is really too much, probably, because I'm running out of time. I just want to say that on general grounds, it's going to be hard to, if you want to UV complete this observation with some theory that generates lepton asymmetry, you have essentially 2 choices. One is to assume that this lepton asymmetry was generated above the electroweak scale. If this happens, however, you need to fight with the spherinons that will tend to re-equilibrate the asymmetry between lepton and baryon because they violate B plus L. And in the end, the answer is that you are going to end up with similar abundances for lepton, for the asymmetry in lepton sector and in baryon sector. This implies that you need to have a way out for this. So one way is to find a way to not have the sphenerons in equilibrium. This is hard in general. So another possible way out that was worked out by this gentleman here, among others, is to have a total lepton asymmetry that is close to zero, like the one of baryons, 10 to the minus 10, but the single lepton asymmetries are different from zero, like, I don't know, Le equal to minus L mu and L tau equal to zero, okay? Now, it seems that also this is problematic, however, for a very recent observation about chiral magnetic effects in the early universe. So if you want to know more, ask me later. So it seems that if there is a lepton asymmetry, a large lepton asymmetry, okay, we're talking about 10 to the minus, I was pointing here, the number is 10 to the minus 2 to 0.1 almost, 0.25 actually. And this range is much greater than 10 to the minus 10 of the baryon, okay? So probably the easiest way from the model building point of view is to do something after the spherions became inactive, that is after electroweak symmetry breaking. And here you have two choices that are kind of been explored already. One is based on leptogenesis scenarios, the other one on Afflecdine variations with some scalars in the theory that have flat directions in the potential and they have a lepton charge. Now, I think I abused a little bit of the time I had at the very beginning, not too bad, but I hope you follow me until the end. So the take home is twofold. The first one is that there's going to be an amazing code in the market. And the second one is that there are two interesting anomalies. And one of them is really pointing to some interesting early universe physics that usually we do not, I mean, at least should speak by myself, for myself, I was not considering so much before reading this paper and learning about the effect of chemical potentials on neutrinos in the early universe. So if this allows us to understand better problems like the baryon asymmetry as one of the main question marks that we have in our theory community, this I don't know. This is actually also something that an invitation for you to think about this. Of course, in the bucket list for the future, we want to have better measurements for helium 4, better measurements for the cross sections of the deuterium, and also the CMB stage 4 or the Simons will possibly say something about this. If you want to see some projections, which I didn't do, and there are some assumptions in these projections, you can look at the paper. And this is all I wanted to tell you today. So much. So, I'm sorry I've been a bit fast in the last part. Hope you have some questions.
So, what is the uncertainty? What would you have to do to take this 2 sigma thing into a 5 sigma?
Okay, very good. Simply the helium 4 together, I would say in these projections, oops, no. So in these projections, there is a claim. This is a paper with Ibarra, Escudero, and another guy. So it's a good paper. And of course, you need to do projections, but like with a better measurement from the CMB, you can constrain more the prior that you have on YP. So on the helium 4 measurement from the anisotropies, for instance. Now, if you believe that also the helium 4 measurement will go beyond percent level with the new telescopes of the next generation, the JWT, I don't know. I mean, the combination of the two will allow, in principle, here there's a claim that you could reach 5 sigma. I don't know if you should believe that. but not the nuclear cross section for the reason that I was telling you before. So helium 4 for nuclear cross sections, because it's just weak. So all this talk was to convince you helium 4 is just weak interactions. Okay, so this, please bring it home.
So out of curiosity,
yes.
So have you checked whether or not this level of neutrino asymmetry would also affect lithium abundance?
Affect what? Yeah.
The predicted lithium 7 abundance.
Very good question. I certainly computed, but I didn't quote it. I think my so the typical scaling of linearized of the lithium 7 with these xenu parameters, I don't remember. I remember that it was still off. The point is that deuterium, helium 3, and lithium 7 are not so good leptometers. They are much better baryometers, so they burn much more on ETA-B. But the number, I don't know. I don't remember. I should check on my chains.
Yeah.
But it's still, I think it's still, I mean, I'm pretty sure it was off. It was still off. I don't know how much, but it was off. I can tell you, I will send you an email with the number. Okay. I mean, after the paper of Olive and Fields this year, and the one that I was describing about the atmosphere and the convection in the low stars, I started to... They almost convinced me that this lithium, I mean, also because the lithium 7 abundance, yeah, I mean, the lithium 7 puzzle, as I know, there was no convincing DSM that could explain that. Okay. And then people showed that these resonant cross sections that could have been another explanation. So, some uncertainty on some cross sections that some resonant peak was not seen in the lab. Then this removed also the cross section uncertainties from the game. Then the only thing that like was left was the physics of convection. Now with this new data on lithium 6 that I was telling you about before, I'm not so excited anymore about lithium 7. This doesn't mean that you should not be.
More questions, maybe from Zoom.
Yes.
So, in your bit, you have the neutron lifetime as a nuisance parameter, but
yeah, yes.
Is there any preference for the neutron lifetime here?
Ah, very good question.
Specific value.
Very good question. So, since I'm assuming a Gaussian prior on that, the answer is no, but it's because I'm assuming a Gaussian prior at the beginning. So, in order to explore that. Aspect, I should have adopted a flat prior and see what was happening. So I didn't do that exercise, but this could be done. As you know,
is your Gaussian covering both measurements?
Yeah, so very good. There are two measurements, one based on a beam and one based on a sort of ultra cold trapping. And the two measurements are far from about 4 sigma or so. So what the PDG does is to inflate the errors with a sort of S-factor approach, and I'm assuming the PDG value. So my error on the neutral lifetime is essentially touching both it's in the middle with a large variance, okay? So it's the PDG value that is in between the two with an inflated error.
Does it matter much for your story?
Well, I mean, the neutral lifetime is important for YP. So the answer, to be honest, is that yes, there would be a correlation between the chemical potential of neutrinos and the neutral lifetime. Yes, it certainly will matter. So it's
interesting to see what you get if you use the latest ECN tab. Very precise.
It's a very good point. Sure, it's a very good suggestion. Thanks. I agree with you. I didn't do it, but I agree with you.
There's another question also in some of the goes for lepton asymmetry, there are these direct neutrino leptogenesis models where you have no number violation whatsoever, and you're just hiding lepton asymmetry in a sterile sector, which is just the right-handed neutrinos. Have you thought about those at all?
I can tell you that there is something in this paper that I'm quoting here, but if I remember correctly, this paper is still using the next to leading version of the classic Majorana right-handed neutrino for leptogenesis. So to be honest, no, I didn't think about it. And the problem is that, I mean, whatever you do, and this is what I wanted to stress in this slide, you should probably do it below the Lechowick scale. I don't think, otherwise you're going to have problems with this chiral plasma instability of this paper that I was talking about. So I honestly, I don't know. I don't know about the, but like if you have some, yes, but.
The point is a lot of these effects like sphalerons, and I'm not quite sure what this chiral plasma instability is, but it probably has to do with the active effect. And that is the direct leptogenesis models, what happens is all of your symmetry is hiding in the sterile sector, which doesn't get affected by sphalerons.
So let me just ask this. The sterile sector is completely neutral under the standard model.
It's the right-handed population in a direct model.
Okay, so if this doesn't imply the generation of some chiral magnetic chemical potential, which is the claim of this paper for this chiral plasma instability, then you're okay. Now, this chiral plasma instability is driven by U1 hypercharge. So if it's sterile, the sector, probably you're right. Probably it's a good way to avoid this. I don't know. I didn't know about this. So Dirac leptogenesis, that's what I should look for. Okay.
Not very well studied, but it's a very interesting idea.
I see. I didn't know about it, so I need to study a paper. Thanks.
Yeah, and also sorry I can't be there. I didn't want to spread my germs to other people. And the final question I had was, when should we expect the code? Because some people are already using it, from what I can see.
Okay.
When the code? When the code will be public.
I hope at the end of the year, I mean, I'll do my best. So now I'm moving from US to Italy, so that's a delay factor, but but I want to have the code out by December. So that's my hope.
Actually,
yes. Yes.
So just,
there is no silly question.
This is the standard model. Like for the other ones, first that it's way, way higher, like lower energies. You have electron number breaking or electron neutrino number breaking because of the Vivens matrix. You have oscillations. You have CP violation. Isn't there an irreducible contribution to if you start with zero primordial neutrino symmetries? Isn't there contribution in the standard model with the symmetry just from out of the equilibrium oscillations? Because, for, of course, for the Wagner symmetry, when people do electrogenesis, then the simulation of the VNS doesn't matter because you can show that the electron that you generate there doesn't depend on the VNS basis. But then they are trying to get the Wagner symmetry and not.
And
forget about that story, just like
within
the standard model,
isn't
there
any
reasonable contribution? Maybe not, because maybe everything is in equilibrium.
I mean, you know, to generate
a
symmetry, you need to meet the Sakharov conditions, no?
Yeah, but you have it, right? You need the non-equilibrium model. But aren't there the oscillations get out of
the
equilibrium at some point, no?
Or don't point today,
so maybe like...
Depends on the sector, to this plot.
Yeah. Start from zero.
Yeah, I understand the question. As far as I know, the answer is no.
It's no?
But
all the oscillations are in equilibrium?
and that sucks.
No, but it's a good. And also, the decoupling of the muon and tau sector is different from the one in the electron a little bit. The onset of the oscillations here is at 10 MeV, while here is, and this depends on the PMNS parameters. And let me say that there is no study at all on systematic study on the uncertainties on the PMNS in relation to these things. Because to do this computation, you really need to solve these nightmare Vlasov equations I was talking about before at the very beginning. It's a six-dimensional phase space distribution for three species. And I mean, it's complicated. So the best that they can do in this study, these guys that are a subset of the primat guys, is to assume some fixed parameters like delta Cp equal to zero, delta Cp equal to pi, theta 1,3 equal to zero, theta equal 1,3 equal to 20 degrees and whatever. So there is no comprehensive study, but as far as I know, as long as you put xi equal to 0,0,0, I think you stay with zero because they're in equilibrium.
Was there anything equilibrium rates? I mean, insulations are in equilibrium.
There is no plot about it, but this is what I understood.
Okay.
It's a good observation. I was not thinking about it. Still, the asymmetry that I'm coming here is very large.
Yeah, but if it was like towards one of the best, it would be a target, like a standard model target, which would be fantastic.
Ah, yeah, that's a very good option.
Great.
Can you repeat the observation? On Zoom, it's hard to hear the audience.
Sorry, didn't get what you said. My observation.
Can you repeat what the very good observation was?
It wasn't.
The observation was just that, like, can you generate just through the phenomena of neutrino oscillations some asymmetry within the standard model? And essentially, this plot, for instance, is showing you that if you start with some zero asymmetry for the electron and muon, you generate it via oscillations because you started with some asymmetry in the tau sector. Now, if you start with 0,0,0 in this plot, you should stay to 0,0,0 according to my understanding, because at the beginning, oscillations are in equilibrium, and there is no way to generate an asymmetry a priori if the initial conditions are zero chemical potentials. That's my understanding. So, is it clearer?
Yes.
Okay.
Stay zero, right?
Oh, okay. Okay.
Any more questions?
Thank you, guys. Mm-hmm.